Blog Talk Radio.
I'm your host, Polk Runyon. Now, tonight we'll present a discussion on magical astrology. Now, we'll begin with the prehistoric origin of the zodiac in the age of Taurus, which is referred to as bullseye astrology, and we'll explain how this began the symbolism of the zodiacal signs. The initiatic code, which some people equate to the 12 labors of Hercules, or Heracles more properly. We will delve into Alexander the Great's emphasis on Aries and the establishment of hoary astrology doctrine by Ptolemy, who was, of course, a follower of Alexander. We will touch on the Orphic Hermetic doctrine of the soul's descent and return, and the geocentric model still used in Hermetic magic. We'll talk about the mansions of the moon, the decans, and astrology's influence on geomancy, tarot, the tree of life, the Kabbalah, and alchemy. And we will talk about the concept of elective astrology. Now, this is a complex and difficult subject to get yourself, to wrap your mind around. So we'll do our best we can to describe it in simple terms. But I'm reminded, as I said once before, about the back in the Beatnik era, back in the 1950s, the UCLA faculty invited D.T. Suzuki over for to give a lecture in the Lyceum in UCLA on Zen Buddhism. And so they packed the auditorium with several thousand students. And this is the story. Anyway, and the curtain opened, and here was this Oriental gentleman wearing his robe, and he bowed to the right, and he bowed to the left, and he bowed to the center, and he looked out at the audience, and he said, "Zen Buddhism, very hard to understand. Thank you." And then he bowed again, and then he turned around and walked back through the curtain, and that was the end of the lecture. Now, we could say magical astrology is very hard to understand, but then, of course, we can't very well duck back through the curtain. We're going to have to explain it to you. Now, first place, right to start with, what is astrology, and why should we give it any credence, and why do we have it? How did it come about, and why is it the ground plan of magic? Why is it so important in Hermetic magic? And it's all important, actually. Well, the reason for that is this: regardless of what you think about the Anunnaki, you know, starting people off being human and all the rest of that stuff. As far as we know, we've been just as intelligent, just as perceptive, and just as clever, and just as smart 30,000 years ago as we are today. Well, and this is curious, too. So back in the, you know, back 30,000 or more or less 27,000 years ago, which I personally think is when this all got started, and we have evidence of that, too, because we have March X lunar calendar from those days and whatever. Back in the, in what we call the Stone Age, we very clever, very subtle, very clever, very ingenious, two-legged critters down here. We looked up at the night sky, and we looked up at the night sky, and we said, wow, boy, look at all the stars up there. I wonder what they mean. Now, there's a book that is very important, and if you're intellectually inclined, and if you can handle a big 600-page book on this, written by a couple of anthropologists, a book called Hamlet's Mill. Now, what these two scientists have proven in Hamlet's Mill is that those ancient people way back then were just as ingenious and just as subtle, just as sophisticated, and just as imaginative as we are today. It's just that they didn't have the technology that we have. They didn't have telescopes. They you know, the furthest planet out they could see was Saturn, and they just had to make their assumptions based upon what they observed. And so that's how astrology came about. And that's how the zodiac came about. It was these Stone Age people looking up at the stars and the shamans making pictures in the sky and saying that these things happen when these things happen. And then they started. And this is all provable now. I mean, it's conjecture. They started with the moon, and the reason why they started with the moon was it's in the night sky. It goes through the stars; you can see it. Whereas the sun, during the day, you know, you really can't see the stars. You don't really know where the sun is in the sky. That takes some extensive calculation. But you know, the Stone Age people would look up, and there's the moon, and they could see it moving through the heavens, and they traced the course of the moon. So astrology and primitive astronomy and the whole business starts off with the moon. And that's why, and that's the reason why in magical astrology, the mansions of the moon, which were the first zodiac and the first astrological system and the first astronomical system, as far as that's concerned. That's why that's still so important. Now, the regular, natal astrologers these days, they don't care about the mansions of the moon at all. They never mention them. But that's where it all started. It started with the mansions of the moon, and the mansions of the moon and the lunar zodiac, which runs along the celestial equator, has its own series of constellations it goes through, and the regular ecliptic zodiac all started right when the Pleiades and Taurus were right on the vernal equinox. Now, this, we can prove that this started about, let's see what Cyril Fagan says here. He says it started around 2500 B.C., well, that's the first cycle of it. I'm going to suggest, knowing about Marchand's lunar calendar and about Cro-Magnon and how smart they were, I'm going to suggest that it was an earlier cycle when Taurus and the moon, when the moon came out of the Pleiades and the bullseye, Aldebaran, and Taurus were on vernal equinox. I'm going to suggest an earlier cycle, which is around 26,000 years ago. And so the zodiac could be, but either way, this is very, very old. And so what we have here were all these signs in the stars, and they weren't always exactly where they are now, and they weren't equal houses, and all this kind of, we've made a lot of refinements on it. But in the earliest days, it started right out of the moon coming out of the Pleiades, out of the thicket, the roebuck jumping out of the thicket, according to Robert Graves, and the bull starting his charge from Aldebaran. Now, I gotta mention that Aldebaran is one of the marker stars. There are four of them. There's Aldebaran, and then there's over in Leo, there's Regulus, and then we have Spica in Virgo, and then we have Fumholt over on the other side. We have these four marker stars. Now, these four marker stars are very, very important in astrology and in magic. And they also, they represent the celestial compass, and they represent, they also represent the Sphinx, the four powers, you know, the eagle, the man, the bull, and the, or you want to call it the ox, and the eagle. So not in that necessarily in that order, but that's that. These marker stars are very, very important. Now, if the zodiac starts in with Aldebaran in back in 2300 BC or earlier, when Aldebaran and the moon were all lined up at vernal equinox, if it starts there, then the symbolism of the signs of the zodiac have a story to tell. And that story's been, you know, some people think that the 12 labors of Hercules reflect that story. This is what can be called the initiatic code. Now, one thing you should understand, though, about this is that this went on for quite a while until, and they didn't really realize what the precession of the equinoxes was until about when 173 BC, some Greek realized that the zodiac was precessing. It was actually moving backwards. So, you know, as you know today, of course, we're about one sign precessed. Now, they didn't quite realize this. In fact, after the Greeks figured this out, the Sabaeans, they kind of thought, well, maybe it moves 8 degrees one way and then it comes back 8 degrees the other way or whatever. They were aware of it, but they didn't really quite know what to do with it for a while. So we had a situation where we're moving into the age of Aries, and along comes about 500 B.C., along comes a fellow who called himself Alexander the Great. Well, he called himself Alexander, and other people said he was great. But he believed he was great. Anyway, he conquered a lot of the known world, and he got over to India. And Alexander founded cities and took Greek culture all over the place, over to India and all the way into Afghanistan and whatever, and into Egypt. And he started a dynasty in Egypt. Cleopatra, of course, was Greek. She wasn't... she wasn't Egyptian, really. She was Greek. And Alexander started this Ptolemaic dynasty. Well, Ptolemy, the Alexandrian king of Egypt, was very, very, very interested in astrology. He was interested in a lot of things to do with magic, but astrology was one of his passions. And so Ptolemy got all of the astrological records from the whole Alexandrian Empire, all the way over to India and everywhere else. He got all this, and he had his scholars codify all these records and get it all together. But instead of starting the zodiac at Aldebaran, in other words, well, peg it right here at Aldebaran and start at 0 degrees Taurus, you know, and go around. Instead of doing that, because Alexander was an Aryan and because Alexander was the age of Aries and whatever, Alexander wanted the zodiac to start in Aries. And because Alexander wanted that, and because of this kind of nascent idea of precession that they had, they went ahead and they changed the zodiac and shifted it and pegged it right at Aries and the lunar zodiac too. So the mansions of the moon got moved to the same place. Now, this was set up in such a way that it wasn't, you know, it was almost doomed not to reflect the heavens by the time it got around the, you know, the 19th or 20th century. I mean, we're almost one sign precessed. Now, if you don't take into consideration the precession of the equinoxes, and when you set this up, you're into something called tropical astrology. Now, I got to explain this a little bit here. This denies the precession of the equinoxes, tropical astrology. So that's what we mostly use today, and that's what the natal astrologers use. And so what you're looking up at the heavens, let's say you're born under the sign of Cancer. Well, you may be born under that sign, but that's not what's up in the heavens when you're born. Now, this went along okay. Nobody really worried too much about this until 1947. Now, in 1947, an astrologer by the name of Cyril Fagan really dug into this whole process, and he proved beyond any doubt that the ancient zodiac really had started in Aldebaran, and the lunar zodiac started in the Pleiades. In other words, the masses of the moon started in the Pleiades, and Aldebaran started off the actual zodiac. Well, this caused a furor in the astrological community when it came out, because they couldn't deny it. I mean, he was right. In fact, yeah, there's no controversy on that. And Dr. Krupp at Griffith Observatory agrees that Fagan was right. And there have been several books out, you know, elaborating on Fagan's discovery. So we all know Fagan was right. There's no doubt about that. But this threw the tropical astrologers into a tizzy, and the sidereal astrologers who had always had, you know, they always kept there, as far as they were concerned, and sidereal astrology, there, what you see is what you get. You look up there, and if Taurus is up there, then Taurus is down here, and that's it. And they go by what's in the heavens, not the seasonal sequence. Now, this controversy blew up, but then the tropical astrologers realized, and they're probably right, that the real, well, of course, they came back and said, they defended themselves by saying, well, come on, Cancer people are the way they are, and Tauran people are the way they are, and Geminis are the way they are, and never the twain shall meet. I mean, that's the way they are, and we've got all the statistics to prove it, and so what are you talking about? Well, what they finally realized was this, that these birth signs are really pegged to the seasons. They're pegged to the seasons of the year. They are not pegged to what's up there in the sky. And once that was realized, then the tropical astrologers continued to do their thing the way they did, and disregard the fact that the stars up there are not up there the way they are. Now, so they were satisfied with that. The sidereal, but there is a whole branch of sidereal astrology. It's not as prominent, but it's there. And they're happy with their way of doing it. But in magic, now, we follow, pretty much follow a tropical, the tropical system, because Ptolemy started that way. And it's been that way ever since. And so much of our old Hermetic literature is based upon that tropical thing. Now, first thing that some of you are going to listening to this are going to say, well, wait a minute, the Golden Dawn? No, they're not. They're sidereal, and they start their zodiac at Regulus. Well, you're right. They do, and because they looked at this thing. But I want you to remember something about this now. That this the Golden Dawn came up with this idea back in the 1860s and the 1870s is when they came up with this sidereal idea, and they pegged it at Regulus. They started off at 0 degrees Regulus. The reason why they did that was because Regulus was the marker star that was right smack on the ecliptic. Hal Dameron's a little bit off, and Humboldt's way off. Spica is close, but Regulus is right on the ecliptic. And it's called the marker star, and the ancient Persians considered it to be the anchor point of the heavens. It's very, very accurate. And so, but the main thing to remember here is that it wasn't until 1947 that Fagan proved that the ancients, the ones who developed the Initiatic Code, the ones who started this whole thing off, they started it in Aldebaran. Now, if the Golden Dawn had known that, if Westcott and Mathers had known that, if Fagan had lived back then, and in 1860 he'd come out with his and proved that Aldebaran is where they started, the Golden Dawn would certainly have started in Aldebaran. I mean, that's absolutely, that's where they would have started. Instead, they didn't know that, so they started at Regulus. And they started there because, as I said, Regulus was right on the ecliptic. Now, this presents, for the magician, this presents a few, some little problems. I mean, for instance, the Golden Dawn took the Shemhan Farash angels and ran them all from 0 degrees Regulus all the way around in a circle. And yet they didn't do the Goetia, and the Goetia remains tropical pretty much. So you can't really take the Golden Dawn's Shemhan Farash sequence and plug it into a tropical sequence of Goetia spirits. Now, Aaron, if you're listening here, as far as the Shemhan Farash is concerned, we stole it fair and square about 400 years ago. So, Tom Rudd and all the rest of the boys have been putting Shemhan Farash sigils on the back of their Galatia sigils for quite a while. So, I know, maybe we shouldn't do it, but doggone it, we've done it for so long, and we might as well continue. However, if you try to use Juan Duquette's master rectangle, it doesn't match up with my master mandala because Lon is, as a lot of Thelemites do, he's still sticking with the Golden Dawn Regulus sequence, and of course we're doing both of ours tropical because I think that's closer to what the Galatian really would be. You need to know these things, and you can say, well, how in the heck are we going to calculate both of these? Well, that's something we've been working on, and we have something coming out in the seventh ray. That will clearly be an eye-opener on that. We figured out a way to combine the two systems, both the sidereal and the tropical, so we can use both of them, and we can use them in different ways. In other words, we figured out how to take the sidereal system and using an old formula that got kind of lost in the shuffle, and reconstructing it, we can put a Greek letter on a gnat's behind on a planet revolving around Alcyone, and we can find it down that precise. We can actually do this. So we're going to be able to, when we get this thing going, we're going to be able to combine the two systems. So you'll be able to use both what you see is what you get and the tropical sequence, which matches up with the seasons. So now you have an idea of the structure of magical astrology and some of its some of its anomalies and some of its dichotomies and one thing or another. But anyway, that's the structure of it. Now, today, tropical natal astrology does not concern itself with making things happen. What it does is it concerns itself with avoiding things that are going to happen. So there's a lot of difference between magical astrology and natal astrology. Magical astrology is referred to technically as elective astrology. Elective astrology means that we are going to take the horoscope, both our own horoscope and a horoscope for an event or whatever, and we're going to look at it. We're going to pick a time and an aspect in the future and whatever, and we're going to be sitting right there waiting to pounce with our talismans and with our magical operations. We will know. So in other words, we're going to make astrology work for us. We're not going to just find out what we got to watch out for. We're going to make it happen. And also, in a more transcendental, more self-development sort of way, we're going to use elective astrology to make up for some of our own shortcomings, astrological shortcomings. If you remember Barton, where we're dealing with four elements, those elements, the four hermetic elements, air, earth, fire, and water, and of course I have spirit, those elements are actually the cardinal signs of astrology. Astrology, the planets are within ourselves, and that's been going on with Pacino and Gitchell and all the rest of it. We know the planets are inside ourselves. We know they affect us. And so, that's our psychic center system is based upon the planets within. And so astrology is really the bedrock of magic. In fact, that wonderful Picatrix, that wonderful translation of the Latin Picatrix that John Michael Greer and Chris Warnock have come up with, that is, if you really want to get into the real meat of medieval elective astrology, that's the book you have to have. And that's the Picatrix book. Chris Warnock also has an astrology course over at a medieval astrology course over at it's Renaissance astrology actually, and you should definitely check that out. I mentioned Amosville and I mentioned the GD and the Regulus thing, but let's kind of deal with something else here. By the way, our producer, Sarah Zandria, is a better astrologer than I am, I'll tell you by a long shot. And we were talking about this whole thing a few days ago, and, she said, well, you can't forget Uranus and Neptune and Pluto. Why, you guys, you're just stopping at Saturn. And you're starting everything at Saturn, and I said, well, sure, that's all we could see in those days. So that's where the physical universe got started, because that's what we could see. We couldn't see beyond that. Yeah, there were little Cro-Magnons, this old caveman. They had sharp eyes, but they still didn't have telescopes. So they started everything at Saturn, and it came on down. Well, now, of course, we know that there's Uranus, there's Neptune, and there's even little Pluto, even though Pluto got deplanetized by a bunch of astronomers that should have known better. They deplanetized poor Pluto. All the kids in school were out, picketing for Pluto to be replanetized. Well, we got to have Pluto with that astrologer, but, we have to have Pluto. So, anyway, what do we do now with our system, which is, frankly, geocentric? Why? Well, that's because the old guys looked up. Those old cavemen, they looked up there and they said, well, it's all going around the Earth. So it must be, we must be the center of the universe. It's all going around us. Okay? So you say now, well, yeah, now we know that isn't true. So why are we going to bother with it? Well, as far as what you're seeing, that's true. And what this whole thing amounts to is your personal reality. In your personal reality, this is the universe. And from a transcendental point of view, in magic, you want to extend your personality out to encompass the universe. That's making yourself more than human. That's encompassing everything in the universe and making it yours. And then, of course, as you know from previous discussions we've had, that the big secret behind hermetic magic is that you are the master of your personal reality. You are the center of consciousness. You are the center of the universe. And therefore, the whole business with astrology and looking up at the stars and looking out at nature is make it all yours. And if you control the universe up there, you can make that work for you. And even if your views are whimsical, and even if they're wrong, if you believe them, if you believe it, and it's what you see, and it's what you've worked out, it'll work for you. I know some of you probably don't believe that, but that's the big secret of magic, really. That's the ultimate secret. And the further out you can extend your view of the universe, the further out you can extend your grasp, your understanding of the universe, then the more powerful you are and the more you can control your own life and control events and whatever. So that's the secret of magic. That's why astrology is so vitally important. And now we get to the point where what are we going to do with Uranus, and what are we going to do with Neptune, and what are we going to do with Pluto? Okay. Now, we can't see them. They look out there, and they're beyond the naked eye. So we can't very well. However, we know they're there. Now, that's a key thing. We know they are there. Now, we can still stay with this geometric system. We can still stay with this hermetic arrangement. We can do it all that. We can swallow that. That doesn't bother us. But the fact that we know those planets are out there means that we've left something out of our little universe here, and we better do something about it. So, consequently, we need to add those planets. Now, my friend Kenneth, I don't know if Ken's still my friend after that nasal satire we did, but Kenneth Grant's very big into this. He's got what he calls the trans-Plutonian Gnosis, and you know, those of you who are into reading Kenneth Grant, and he's a lot of fun to read, you know that he has a trans-Plutonian Gnosis. He's bringing in, he's integrated these outer planets into his version of the Typhonian Gnosis that he has. Now, we need to do the same thing, and you're going to say, well, gosh, this is an awful lot of work. What do we do? And fortunately, if you remember last week, we were talking with Art Conkin, who is one of the graduates of old Frater Albertus, that's Albert Rydell's alchemy school over in Salt Lake. You know, they had every summer for 2 weeks, they studied alchemy over there for a 7-year course. And old Frater Albertus from the Paracelsus Institute, he got to thinking the same thing. The same thought ran through his mind. Well, we know those planets are out there, so we have to include them. So he laboriously, in his good German scholarship, he did a book. And if you can find it, if you're really interested in this, and Michael Downs, I really want to plug you into this one. Beg, borrow, or steal a copy of 7 Rays of the QBL. And QBL, of course, means Kabbalah. That's by Frater Albertus. And Weiser published it, and I forget how long ago they published it. Beautiful, beautiful book. It has all kinds of color, beautiful color charts. In fact, Albertus was so conscientious about this, he even got the Technicolor Corporation to do his color separations for him. And he has, this book, he redesigns the Tree of Life to take into consideration these outer planets. And so that solves that problem, and he's done it for us, and that's a great contribution. Now, I'm going to discuss something that we did some time back that has, I think, a great deal of magical astrological significance. And in fact, we have an illustration that we're posting on the page. We're having an illustration from issue number 16. This is issue number 16 of the seventh ray, volume 5, number 1, spring, summer, 1976. That's a while back. And what we have in here is something of a revelation. That's a fairly short article, but now that I've given you the background of magical astrology, I hope I've made it understandable. I'll see if you can follow this one. I apologize for it being a little technical, but I think you'll get the gist of it. Now, it says, Return of the Holy Grail in the Age of Aquarius Leo. Now, the cover of Volume 4, Number 2 of the Seventh Ray for Summer-Fall 1975 shows the Archangel Gabriel standing with her chalice in the western quadrant. Behind her, a waxing moon is setting over the water, flanked by a constellation of stars low on the horizon. This constellation is the macrocosmic symbol of the ancient celestial initiatic code representing the Holy Grail. It is the Crater, guarded by Leo and Leo Minor, and carried by the primeval serpent Hydra, and tended by the Earth Queen Virgo. In the following issue, number 15, Winter Solstice 1975, there appeared a poem by this writer, which ended with a cryptic stanza declaring, Whoso enlivens the microcosm shall transcend as a free and winged soul to follow the raven beyond the western gate while the dragon rules the quarter, marching in procession with the grail to equinox, even as the seven-veiled goddess brings death unto death. So shall the epic of the self-borns be soon adawning, when the seekers shall be masters, and the lifeblood shall be light. Now, it's been our intention to thus gradually unveil what may be the most significant manifestation of a neo-pagan gnosis in the present era. And we have been moved to reveal this discovery because of its prophetic aspect and its predictions of a coming golden age when the Western tradition will manifest its destiny. We cannot in good conscience withhold such an oracle from our colleagues at large, especially when it is written in the stars and will surely come to pass. What will happen is this. By the doctrine of astrological polarities, through which we conceptualize zodiacal signs in a complementary sense, for example, the 180-degree opposite of Virgo is Pisces, hence the reference to Virgo Pisces, it will be observed that when we enter the age of Aquarius Leo, signified by the vernal equinoctial point moving into the constellation Aquarius via the precession of the equinoxes, there is an opposite effect 180 degrees around the zodiac, bringing the autumnal equinoctial point into Leo. However, the lion rides high on the ecliptic, under his feet, swimming winter shins from Virgo to Cancer. On a direct line with Aquarius, we find Hydra, the sea serpent, an ancient Argonautic constellation rightly equated with Tiamat, Lotan, or Ophion, the beast of chaos. And on the back of this celestial leviathan is born the Crater, the cup, said said by the ancient Greeks to have been the goblet of Apollo, but philosophically analogous to Plato's receptacle of becoming, in a symbolic sense, and certainly the crater referred to in the fourth Hermetic treatise, which modern scholarship has established as the Holy Grail of the medieval Parseval. Its position in relation to the autumnal line of declination is virtually identical with that of the gush from the amphora of Aquarius to the vernal line on the other side of the zodiac. Behind the crater, riding on the tail of the serpent, we find Corvus the Raven, a universal symbol of death and transformation. And as we enter the age of Aquarius Leo, we also enter the age of Aquarius Crater, as a brief study of a star map or celestial sphere will show. And not only because of the juxtaposition via the theory of polarity, but iconographically as well, for the stream of water from Aquarius's amphora is being poured into the crater on the opposite side of the zodiac. And if we accept the theory that the constellations form an ancient initiatic code, remembering that crater is one of the oldest and also recalling the knowledge of the phenomenon of equinoctial precession, and that it considerably predates the Christian era, we must seriously consider the possibility that the pagan astrophilosophers who formulated the cosmic panorama were predicting an age of transcendence after Pisces Virgo. This is not difficult even for non-mystical scholars to accept in light of the intellectual trends during the Hellenistic period preceding the rise of Christianity. As a synchronicity, we should also consider the Kabbalistic concept of the Shemitot, a great cycle of 6,000-year periods, each period, or Shemata, being under the aegis of a Sephirah. Presently, we are in the Shemata of Geburah, the age of judgment. This has some affinity with the Eastern Kali Yuga, which, significantly enough, is to be followed by a golden age, the Krita Yuga, dating the beginning of the Shemata. It's historically impossible and allegorically controversial. The expulsion from the Garden of Eden has been suggested as one date of commencement, and the Great Flood as another. If we accept the former and recall Bishop Usher's literal genealogical calculation of the date of creation, I have a footnote on that. Archbishop James Usher published this in 1650, in a few years later, his colleague, Dr. Lightfoot in Cambridge, refined the Archbishop's allegation and declared that the world had been created and in 4000 B.C., 4000 B.C. at 9 a.m. on October 23rd. Dating the beginning of the Shemitah is historically impossible and allegorically controversial. The expulsion from the Garden of Eden has been suggested as one date, and the commencement of the Great Flood as another. If we accept the former and recall Bishop Usher's literal geographical or genealogical calculation of the date of creation, subtracting a few years for Adam and Eve to wander about the garden, we can date the expulsion circa 4000 B.C. And to this, now of course this is all mythological, to this we could add at least 2,000 years to complete the period, and meaning that we will be entering the Shemitah of Tiphereth, the golden era of solar harmony, at the same time we enter the astrological age of Aquarius Leo. And finally, we should consider that the Kabbalistic doctors knew the constellation Crater, which they called the Kos, or the cup. and certain distinguished scholars of ancient mysticism maintain that the concept of a chalice filled with divine substance is a Gnostic development of an earlier Jewish theme, which we suggest was originally a Canaanite myth ritual motif perpetuated from the Neolithic. The significance of this celestial grail in its relationship to the New Age is deep and far-reaching. But before delving further, we should clear away a previous misconception. The myth of the Holy Grail did not originate with any particular race, religion, or culture, and then spread to others via diffusion, as Celtophiles, Anglophiles, and Francophiles have ethnocentrically argued for years.
Our Holy Grail is better than your Holy Grail, you stupid British person, you! I thought for your general direction.
You remember that from Monty Python. Okay, it predates civilization entirely, going back to the time when that first shaman priest served his tribal initiates mead, wine, or sun, or soma from the bowl he kept, especially for that purpose. Perhaps inset in a human skull. How long ago was this? Before there were such people as Celts, Greeks, Jews, or Samaritans. Before the Shemitah of Geburah and the age of Taurus, Scorpio. And if we will meditate on the antiquity of our sacred implements, the wand, the spear, or staff, the cup, and the cauldron, the sword or knife, and the pentacle, the plate or the shield, we may come to realize that they are the archetypes of man's original creations, the very tools and weapons with which he made himself human, and with which he may someday make himself more than human. There is, however, a catch in this otherwise egocentric metamorphosis that confounds the proud. The grail is a vessel of the spirit. One may not drink from it unless one has prepared a similar vessel within to receive the draught. Physically, it is symbolized by the womb, the ocean, the moon, and the constellation Crater. Spiritually, it is the body of light, the sea of light, the sphere of memory, and the cosmic vortex of rebirth, where the soul encounters the sun beyond the sun. And there is an exoteric tradition that the celestial whirlpool lies at the foot of Orion and is the source of the stellar river Uranus. But the position of Crater on the ecliptic and its specific symbolism leads us to conclude it is the true Ashiya Palace beyond Saturn. We are not forgetting that the Milky Way is the primordial river of souls, and the gates of death and rebirth are marked where it bisects the zodiac. But all souls are not born under the sign of Gemini. They orbit the ecliptic, drawn by the tides of the moon, the planets, and the Earth's sphere to be born in their proper season. Macrobius, circa 500 A.D., suggested that the Crater contain the waters of oblivion and affect the river Lethe, and that returning souls who drank of it would not remember past lives. However, the ancient adepts of the Orphic mysteries held an opposite belief. The sublime elegance of their celestial symbolism should not be fully divulged here. Rather, should it be sought by the student himself, guided by the ample clues we have provided. He will have fully fathomed the mystery when he knows what lies between holly and vine on the spokeless wheel. Check the poems of Robert Graves to find that one. In a gross physical sense, we might think of Crater as an astronomical black hole, a great vortex warping time and space not to be confused with the circumpolar maelstrom. Philosophically, it is a crucible wherein the opposing doctrines of magic and mysticism are finally reconciled, and spiritually, it is best defined as the goal of the Grail Quest. If we infer by polarity that Aquarius, the water bearer, is pouring the contents of his amphora into Crater, we may then recall that when the initiatic code was formulated, Aquarius, ruled by Saturn, marked the winter solstice, the time of the sun's rebirth. With this solar and Saturnian significance in mind, let us reconsider the words of thrice greatest Hermes. Having filled a great cup of this gnosis, he sent it down with a herald and commanded him to proclaim to the hearts of men, baptize yourselves, you who are able, into this cup, and who is believing that he shall return to him who hath sent down the cup, and who recognizes for what he was generated and by whom. It is implicit that we are supposing a vast antiquity for the concept of astrological polarities. We have also suggested a major extension of zodiacal symbolism to include adjoining constellations, and even if there were no objective proofs to support our argument, the profound synchronicities are compelling enough to establish the Crater as the celestial grail. In the Hermetic Kabbalistic tradition, its coming with Aquarius Leo heralds a golden age when men will look to the stars beyond, and in the dark mirror of the firmament, man shall see reflected the stars within. To Asdeus, and that was delivered in 1976. Now, that sounds kind of Kenneth Grantish, actually, I hope some of that came through. We're going to publish that and several other very, very interesting articles from the original Seventh Ray magazine back in the 70s. We'll publish them in an omnibus form, Seventh Ray Omnibus, which will be coming up sometime after we get the Green Ray out. I'd like to recommend a couple of books here that are in the bibliography of what we just read. De Santayana and Giorgio's Hamlet's Mill, yeah, I mentioned that before. Robert Graves' The White Goddess and the Collected Poems. Now, that reference to the Orphic secret is in the Collected Poems of Robert Graves. Then there's a book by Kahane and Kahane called The Crater and the Grail, and that's the Hermetic aspects of the Grail legend. We also delved into Plato's Timaeus and Critias. And last but not least, Hinckley Allen's Star Names, their lore and meaning. That's the best handbook for everything you want to know about the stars. Now, the one that, of course, that we mentioned to start with was Cyril Fagan, that's CYRILFAGAN, Cyril Fagan's Astrological Origins. And that's the documentation, original documentation from 1947 on the Aldebaran zodiac. Now, that's a Llewellyn publication, and they issued it, I think, reissued it back in 1971, as you were. And that's I think still in print. If it's not, it's certainly available. This is, as I said, a very complex, but it's a fascinating subject. I recommended John Michael Greer and Chris Warnock's Picatrix, translated from the Latin medieval grimoire of the same, and that's probably the premier book on medieval Renaissance astrological magic. That's, I think, is a good introduction to the subject of astrological magic, and we'll be looking forward to your comments on this. Next week, we're going to delve into this whole process of angelic theurgy and the making and the use of talismans. And here again, this will build upon what we've been discussing tonight. So we're going to have next week is going to be angel magic and the creation and the use of talismans. This will be a kind of a practical situation. And we'll be taking call-ins next week. So, you know, get ready to call in. You can ask about anything we've been talking about on any previous shows. And we invite you to call in. And you remember that next week, that call-in number is area code 347-857-1830. So let's call in next week, and we'll hear from you. Next week it'll be angel magic and talismans. So until then, have a good evening and good magic, and we'll see you then.